Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking as we do most weeks at this time at the worlds of economics and politics. Two guests up today, as usual. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Kevin Gray, a writer and activist from South Carolina, on the curious brand of politics in his home state that was brought to national attention by the recent Republican primary. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Catherine Liu, who teaches at the University of California, Irvine, and is author of the book American Idol, Academic Anti-Elitism as Cultural Critique, about education, testing, anti-intellectualism, and the shallow but pervasive politics of anti-elitism. No time for news commentary today. There's just too much interview material. My first guest is Kevin Alexander Gray, a writer and organizer based in South Carolina. There was a lot of all-too-easy commentary about that state in the wake of Newt Gingrich's victory there, so I thought it was worth checking in with Kevin for a more complex and informed analysis. Kevin Gray. Welcome, Kevin. I feel a little guilty calling you just because South Carolina's in the news. I should do this more often.
You really should, but I love you anyway.
Oh, thank you. But South Carolina is in the news. Were you at all surprised by the Gingrich victory?
No, and when you look at the numbers, I think Gingrich got, 200,000 votes in the primary. Gingrich's vote was the anti-Haley vote. In Haley's primary run in the GOP, a gubernatorial race, and it was a runoff, but in the primary, there were about 215,000 votes against her, which threw her into a runoff. She didn't have, 50+1. But anyway, in the runoff, there were 115,000 votes against her. So you kind of figured Newt's base, which was an anti-Haley vote, and that was that vote from the legislators who were called a turban head, that's that hardcore racist vote. You know, and you come into South Carolina where race is in play all the time, which is why it's so surprising when the national media comes in and they say, South Carolina, and it was a nasty racial race. Well, you know, Lee Atwater was from South Carolina. Howard Dent, who developed the Southern Strategy for Richard Nixon, was from South Carolina. The Dixiecrats in Strom Thurmond, the state operates on its history of race, and it's being the soul of the Confederacy and the state that started the Civil War. It's the ideological home of white supremacy in this country, and that's the way the politics are always played here. The Democrats do it, and the Republicans do it, so it always works. But with the Democrats, it works in the opposite. You know, you try to build your credibility with the black vote in some way, shape, form, or fashion. When Bill Clinton was the black president, that played. Barack Obama coming in with Hillary and being black, racial solidarity played. But that's how it plays. And Newt Gingrich won that vote clearly.
On Twitter the other day, a New York Times reporter said that he was shocked. Every time he goes to South Carolina to see the Confederate flag over the state capitol, are they tone deaf? I suggested to him maybe they actually like it, and he said, oh, yeah, there's that. But that really is what it's all about. It really is the old cause, isn't it?
Well, you know, that flag is beside a Confederate soldier that and just beside the Robert E. Lee Highway, you know? Just about every street is named after a Confederate hero. A lot of public buildings, you know, they're resurrecting the submarine Hunley down in Charleston. Everybody, all the national media came to South Carolina, and they rushed to Charleston because it was the city that most resembled a city here that they're familiar with. And Charleston's whole tourism business is based on slavery. Now, I don't know how hard it is to get that. Maybe some of the reporters ought to read a history book before they come here. Look, Tancredo came here. Buchanan came here. They lined up with the Confederates, the folk that fly the Confederate flag, Maurice Bessinger. John McCain came here. He hired Warren Guzet as his campaign consultant. His father edited a magazine called Southern Partisan Magazine, which is a magazine of the Old South that did that whole campaign to keep the flag on the State House, Heritage Not Hate, with the big picture of Abraham Lincoln with the phrase death to tyrants. I mean, you know, and this is just as in South Carolina. You can go all up and down the east coast of the United States, south of the Mason-Dixon line from Virginia to Florida, all these national parks that are monuments to the Confederacy. South Carolina, they just don't fake the down here, as we say. But listen, we live in a profoundly racist country. That's what people ought to understand. And you can't ever seem to find a racist in a profoundly racist country. And the thing about South Carolina, I guess I do appreciate, is that at least the racists don't disguise their racism so cleverly.
Now, you said the Gingrich vote was the anti-Haley vote. Is there some portion of the Republican electorate that doesn't like secretly to dress up in bedsheets?
Well, you know, as I said, you're not ever going to get the one thing that white folk have is being white. That's what they have over everybody else. And that's just always going to play here. And it's going to play in other places, too. I mean, it plays every time the Republicans talk about Reagan Democrats, although most of them ought to be dead by now. You know, as I said, that's not just South Carolina. This is a racist country. And this state's politics cling to race and its historical connection to race and racial division and racial supremacy. We're dealing with a constitution here that was written to protect white male hegemony. And that's pretty much the issue all across the country. I mean, you talk about crony capitalism, vulture capitalism, Wall Street socialism. I mean, that's all about protecting a certain class of people, maintaining control. As I said, here, it's just broken down in a way that people think that they can viscerally understand or physically understand because black folk and white folk and brown folk have a different complexion and people place more value on being white.
I noticed in a map that broke down the vote by county, the areas around Columbia and Charleston went for Romney. Does that mean anything?
Well, those are cities, and you would suspect that those would be the places where the more moderate Republicans are. The upstate is the buckle of the Bible Belt. In fact, what's that little hook that goes into this that's at the middle of the buckle, the fulcrum? That's it. And so, you know, they vote along evangelical lines and really, really conservative lines. That's where Bob Jones is. So when you consider a Catholic, I mean, a lot of those folk believe that the Pope is the Antichrist. The evangelicals aren't necessarily pro-Catholic. Now, they might vote for Gingrich because they think he's not really Catholic. He might have converted to it, but he was raised as a Protestant, so they'll give him that. But when you compare that to, let's say, a Mormon, I don't think fundamentalists make any secret that they don't believe that Joseph Smith ought to be put on the same theological level as Jesus. That's that. Sure, if you've got two Catholics and a Mormon, the converted Catholic who claims he's from the South plays race. Well, I would suspect that the converted Catholic from the South who plays race would win out.
When Gingrich was talking about the food stamp president, I mean, he wasn't really referring to the fact that we have record numbers of people on food stamps, right? This was the classic dog whistle message.
Well, you know, the code that everybody that been cracked a long time ago, black folk are violent, gangbangers and rappers. Black folk are lazy, the welfare mother and food stamps. Black folk are criminal, the drug wars. Black folk don't live up to their responsibilities. You black men need to stop being boys. It's basic. It's very basic. The welfare queen. It's Ronald Reagan going to Philadelphia, Mississippi to talk about states' rights. It's not anything that's new. It's old. Black folk are shiftless and lazy and are waiting on the government dole. It's like Newt Gingrich took his script from old brother where art thou. He's Homer Stokes. And he's going to send the interest back to the farm.
Does his viciousness, does that appeal to a certain portion of the South Carolina electorate? Gingrich has some of the highest negatives in American politics, yet is that a positive appeal to some people?
Listen, I think that white male Southerners in particular and in this country believe that they are more valuable than everybody else. That's just my personal belief. I'm sorry. And everybody ascribes to have that kind of power. As the bad model, the model of white male hegemony, is not just in South Carolina. It's just more evident because of the state's history. So I don't want to just put that on South Carolina like the racism's all confined here, and then when you leave here, you ain't going to see it anymore, because that's not true. But as it relates to, you know, just using race and thinking that somebody's going to take something from you. Well, the Republican Party does that all across the country. I mean, Karl Rove, when he ran George Bush for governor, and, of course, when he ran for president, back then the boogeyman was gay folk and gay marriage. Of course, everybody tries to make it the brown people with immigration. Those Mexicans going to come in and take those jobs that you just won't do. And those black folk, they're going to take your tax money and spend it, get welfare, and spend it on Cadillacs. That's old stuff.
I was struck the last few days how it seemed a lot of liberals and Democrats just couldn't get it over, saying over and over again that the South Carolina Republican voters are just a bunch of racists, as if no one else was. But it was also a kind of looking down their noses that South Carolina almost fills an emotional need for certain people in the North.
Liberals, listen, there are liberal racists and there are conservative racists. Liberals can't see themselves as not being racist. See, not, and some of the reason that they're stung, because some of that language does sting. I mean, how do you talk about the fact that you've got a president who came into office and signed that TARP, turned over all that money to Wall Street, meanwhile you had record foreclosures and record unemployment, and then he's hiring all those Wall Street people around him. And the food stamp rolls are increasing, not just for black folk, but for white folk and everybody. Now, hey, that's something to deal with. Now, that's not, as I said, most of the people on food stamp are not black, so if you say that, that's racist, because, and it's not true. But now, the fact that the president came in protecting big business in Wall Street, that's also very true. And so you play the folks' anxieties, and they're looking to be mad at the thing that's closest to them that they can visualize. And usually, as I said, that's or an enemy. But as I said, if Barack Obama gave a speech and said, you black folk need to do better, like he came to South Carolina, somebody asked him, well, what kind of economic policy do you think will work in the black community? He said, well, I think the first thing black folk ought to do is clean up their neighborhoods. Or even in that church, going to a black church on Father's Day and say, I think you black men need to stop acting like boys. If Newt Gingrich and them said that, man, we'd be going off. And that's all the same thing. See, liberals call what Newt Gingrich says, if it comes out of a liberal's mouth, tough love. They hypocrites, too.
I'm speaking with Kevin Gray, who is a writer and activist based in South Carolina. Hey, let's talk about Obama. I'm guessing that he is pretty much what you expected of his presidency.
I had no expectations. But, you know, what saddens me is, to some extent, his core constituency, although they're going to vote for him, black folk and liberal white folk are going to vote for Barack Obama in the general election. They're not going to vote for a third-party candidate. They're not going to vote for Republicans. So that's a done deal. But to be going out of their way and twisting arguments to defend some of the stuff that this president has done, to attack your constitutional rights, thinking that somehow, well, he's not torturing anybody, he's just assassinating them. Or, as I said, hiring all these Wall Street bankers around him. You know, it's got to be more than him singing a song. He should have got Bill Clinton with that saxophone. They could have been did a duet. But, you know, when you look at what this president's policies economically and whose side he has been on and the way that folk bend over backwards to defend that, it's sad. It's sad. People need to start looking beyond this election, figure out what they need to do to really challenge the power to change the dynamic between the 99 and the 1%, and this erosion of our constitutional rights, and this erosion of civil society, and government being involved in crony capitalism and supporting vulture capitalism and Wall Street socialism. Those things are the same thing. You know, when Obama gives his buddies at Solyndra money, it's the same as George Bush giving his buddies at Halliburton the leg up in Iraq and in New Orleans. It's the same thing. Why aren't we talking about how do we deal with the credit modernization bill, which is why so many black folks had to go into Chapter 13 instead of Chapter 11 or Chapter 7, and why they continue to lose their houses, and all these lawyers who used to represent black folk in bankruptcy decided to get out of lawyering because they couldn't deal with the liability. Why do we not talk about that kind of stuff? We talking about, hey, man, Barack Obama really sang that Al Green song at the Apollo.
Why are people talking about that rather than what you, you know, what you said before?
Well, in the black community, if you criticize Obama, there's a cadre of people who will go after you, like all those morning talk show hosts, the way they went at Tavis, although Tavis brings a lot of that on himself because Tavis is a movement entrepreneur. And that's fine. Colin Powell make $100,000 a speech. Tavis make $37,000. It don't matter. They can do that. But don't pretend you're being a champion of the people, because that's, and when the next day you'll be cutting deals with Wells Fargo, or you got McDonald's sponsoring your whatever meeting you're having, Tavis Smiley, sponsored by McDonald's. You know, you're not there for the people like that. So let's not front. You got a right to, but the point is, you will be attacked. And you cannot have a sensible conversation in the community these days, in the black community, about Obama. Not a rational one. And if there's a breakdown of our organizations, the NAACP, which is the primary organization, because they just become a political arm of somebody. Or they're not there unless it's an occasion where you can step up in front of the mic or the camera. Ain't no grassroots organizing going on in the black community. There's no kind of political consciousness and coherency anymore. Obama occupies the space, but he doesn't. He's not president of black America, but he might as well be.
Would something similar be going on if it were Hillary or some other white Democrat, or does he intensify it?
I think that if there were a white Democrat in office or anybody else, I think that there would be a different level of organizing. And at least there'd be some advocacy, and at least you'd have some leverage. But now it is as though that's the prize. And the other thing is, you know, you folks are proud of that, and some of the racist attacks on him are not just attacks on him. If you're attacking somebody black, saying that they don't have competency solely because they're black, or this idea, as I said, of the food stamp president, which means that, you know, he's just another black person wanting to get something out of the system and feed that to black folk. Well, that's a slander against black people. So, you know, you're going to circle up your wagons around that because it's broader than just him. But as far as his policies are concerned and what he does for them, I mean, you know, you got all these civil rights leaders going around supporting, what is that, American Jobs Act. That president's looking out for you. Well, you and I both know that it undermines Social Security, and that the people that are aligned with Barack Obama are Wall Street people that want Social Security to be privatized, just like the Republicans. So they wanted to be driven into bankruptcy. That's why it's stealing the money to pay for the wars. So you and I know that, but the people don't know that, and they can't even envision that. All they know is they got some more extra money to go out and spend on a facsimile of luxury. Go out to Walmart. Go wherever.
How do we break out of this, then?
Well, I mean, as I told a young brother a while ago, and it's, I'm getting a lot of calls from young people these days. The first part of it is consciousness. We just got to get people to have the same kind of political consciousness I would think that we had during the Vietnam War, during the Civil Rights Movement, when we were thinking politics, and during desegregation, we were understanding what politics and policy did, and reestablishing some kind of coherent, progressive message, and what does progressivism mean? I was reading Michael Myers' piece, and I guess it was in Huffington Post, on Buchanan being banned. Or being kicked off of MSNBC, and I was watching some of the traffic on Facebook. Yeah, good, get that racist off TV. You know, being progressive isn't about censorship or making sure that only your voice and your political perspective is the one being heard, because the left has that problem. We've got to teach people some fundamental principles about civil society and the social contract just at that level, just a civics lesson. What is the Fourth Amendment about? What is privacy? Why don't you want to make sure that you control the police and limit the power of the police? You know, just some rational, why you don't want to go and spend money overseas in wars? And who benefits from that? And you can't necessarily do that in the mainstream media and on TV. You can't use the mechanisms that want that all that stuff to be in place to educate the people. I mean, why would MSNBC or NBC or ABC or CBS or CNN, all of them have reporters embedded with the soldiers during war? They got special vehicles, you know. They bought into the daily briefings with the general or the colonel or whoever as their primary source of information. They run the government line. You talk about campaign finance reform. Well, who makes all the money when all these cats are spending money in campaigns? The TV people, the media people. They want all the money they can get. And the Carvels and the media consultants, they all make their money selling those ads. They become millionaires on this stuff. That's the industry. And those cats don't want changes. So people got to get a hold of what it is that we're doing. Are we against the war? Are we against imperialism? This basic kind of stuff. But you know, my sometimes ally, Reverend Jackson, you know, you can't ride the freedom on Pharaoh's chariot, and everybody want to ride and whip the horses.
Is electoral politics just a distraction from real politics?
Well, you know, for some people, I mean, this is where it starts. I mean, I started doing, you know, marching people against the police, but for some people, this is where it starts. It is a distraction. And, you know, as I said earlier, people are going to vote who they're going to vote for. For the most part, if you're going to vote for Obama, you're going to vote for Obama. If you're going to vote for whatever racist clown the Republicans put out there, you're going to vote for him. Folk like me are more predisposed to vote for the third party candidate. It would take a lot. It would take the repeal of the National Defense Authorization Act for me to vote for Barack Obama. And so, you know, a lot of stuff would have to be done. You'd have to be, you know, when this budget comes out, you know, it can't be a further retreat from helping people in times when they need help. So, you know, it'd take a lot. But, people need to start thinking about organizing beyond this and what's a set of things that we can organize around. And then understand, you know, I had an argument about Ron Paul yesterday where someone said, I said, you know, Ron Paul keeping the anti-empire, anti-war, anti-police state, anti-war on drugs message out there. I don't care if he's not going to win the Republican nomination. But for someone to have that out there, because the media's not just ignoring Ron Paul, that's what they're ignoring. So to have that out there is a good thing to some degree because it forces Obama in some way to have to deal with it. His problem is going to be young, white, disaffected voters who are not going to be as enthused as they were the first time. They might just sit it out. That's his problem. So to have someone within the Republican Party forcing that on the platform isn't a bad thing, especially when you look at what's going on the state level with the Democratic Party platforms. Well, they're basically changing their platforms on the local level to conform with almost what the Republicans are saying in terms of being against the unions and pro-capitalism, that kind of thing. And people need to be aware of that. So there's a lot of organizing that needs to be done. And the resources need to be gathered to do the organizing. But it's not going to be online, and it's certainly not going to be just at the ballot box. It's like going to meetings again and really meeting and talking about politics and making politics a real part of our everyday conscious culture.
I was Kevin Gray, a writer and activist based in South Carolina. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break to talk about the life and death of the mind. Some of the famous chaconne from Bach's Partita No. 2 for solo violin, performed by Henrik Schiering. My next guest is Catherine Liu, director of the University of California, Irvine's Humanities Collective, and author of American Idol. That's with a Y, not an O. Academic Anti-Elitism as Cultural Critique from the University of Iowa Press. She had invited me out to Irvine to give a talk about the economic mess we're in, so I took the opportunity to have a chat with her about schools testing anti-intellectualism and its traveling companion, anti-elitism. Catherine Liu. Welcome, Catherine. We are now, of course, up to our ears in education testing, and so I think it's a good time to look at some of the history of all this in the country. Give us a history of where this whole practice of standardized testing emerged.
Well, the standardized testing really has its origins in the IQ test, which was pioneered in the early 20th century by a French psychologist who was really wanting to test for disabilities and special needs in Paris at the time. And the original IQ test was meant to be administered one student at a time with five psychologists in the room. And believe it or not, it was meant as part of a progressive move on the part of psychology to deal with the social needs of the urban poor, the educational needs of the urban poor.
Well, it was diagnostic then.
Yeah, it was diagnostic, but very, very layered. So it was not an instantaneous score that would be that would emerge. However, from its origins, it always projected an average intelligence based on age. This is why it's so important in the history of developmental psychology. If you have to believe that an age group like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 has an average intelligence, each child within an age is compared to the average intelligent child of that age, the average intelligence of that age. When Americans discovered this,
how is intelligence measured?
Through the manipulation of and the solution of puzzles. And, you know, we've all taken IQ tests, and in fact, they're part of an array of tests that you can take online when the flash comes up and it says, you know, solve these puzzles. It's very explosive, short-term logical reasoning questions that is supposed to be geared towards each age group. So you can solve circles and triangle puzzles. Patterns and prediction of patterns is a very important part of IQ tests now, because the idea is that you can even test the IQs of children who are not reading and writing yet.
So when Americans got a hold of this, what happened?
When Americans got hold of this, they went hog wild. One of the first applications of the IQ test was to sort soldiers during World War I. The Stanford-Binet test was seen as an instrument by which military recruiters for World War I could figure out who was more apt to be a good officer and who was more apt to be just a soldier. There were many tests given at the time geared towards people who didn't speak English, for instance, because of the large number of immigrants who were entering the country. And lo and behold, immigrants usually tested lower. They were less likely to become officers, and they were more likely to be in the trenches. This scientific ordering, and what I would call the IQ test as a social technology, really sparked the imagination of eugenicists, the social Darwinists of the time, and Carl Brigham Young, for instance, who really was an early testing pioneer, was a virulent racist and published racist tracts. But I think even more than that, it was a way for American scientists or psychologists, social scientists as an emerging field at the time, it was a way for them to provide some kind of justification for social inequality, economic inequality. Certain people just don't have certain capacities. They need to be helped, and that's the sort of progressive era idea. They need to be accommodated. They can be addressed. Their needs can be addressed. But what we have is an incredible way of determining, and eventually it becomes really a social determinant, who and what class is incapable of higher forms of reason.
So at this time also, people like Harvard presidents were issuing pronouncements about what public education should be like, right?
Ivy League presidents were very, very innovative in terms of trying to understand how to reform education from the top down, to produce forms of education, you know, in the 1890s that would deal with the needs of industrial democracy, as John Dewey was to call them. And by 1945, James Bryant Conant saw the GIs returning home, saw the ills of that had been produced by the very nepotistic and corrupt forms of selection that had filled Ivy League halls with the scions, the poor and rich scions of WASP East Coast, Eastern Seaboard elites. And so he really wanted to create a way of selecting a new elite.
And how did they go about this?
And that became the establishment of the Educational Testing Services.
In what year was this?
It happened in the early 50s, but Conant really put Henry Chauncey to the task in like 1947 was when they started developing the College Board tests that today are run by Educational Testing Services located in Princeton, New Jersey. And Henry Chauncey was like a poor WASP, you know, he was a man of great zeal and idealism with regard to cognitive science and psychology. And he found the Stanford Binet tests, he found the IQ tests, and he actually pushed for what we know of today as the multiple choice test.
Now let's step back a bit. You mentioned Dewey and progressive education. How does he fit into this story?
So this is Hofstadter's thesis, not mine, but I really think we should all repeat it over and over again. Hofstadter sees all this happening in the 50s and 60s, standardized testing and progressive education's rise and fall and rise again, and he says, why are American schools burdened with the task of remedying social ills, and why are they so bad, and why is American education so bad? Well, he says that from the teens and 20s and 30s up to the 40s, Americans are willing to accept these kinds of progressive education as an institutionalized form of anti-authoritarianism. At first, it's very small institutions like the Chicago Lab School that decides that the curriculum should follow and adapt to children's lives and needs. And this is a beautiful thing. It happens in the progressive classroom in elementary schools, but in sort of really progressive schools today, children are taught to, for instance, about agriculture, but they plant gardens and they look at animals, and then they, you know, they'll have pets. There's this notion.
My kid is doing this in kindergarten.
You see,
studying birds.
So it's about integrating the curriculum to the life world of the child, and it's all about addressing the needs of the whole child. And the curriculum will be driven by what is of interest to the child. Well, by the 40s and 50s, Hofstadter's looking at this and saying, you know what, that life world, Dewey's concept is too plastic. It's become reified as sort of job preparation, because the life world will all be about competition, and the interest of the child is going to lose all of its aspects of curiosity and exploration, and it's going to become reified as self-interest.
And what about the corporate interest in all this? How did the business interest shape this process?
The corporate interest, can I go back to the Dewey thing? So this is at the root of the culture wars of the 1980s, because already the Americans don't have very deep commitments to the canon, right? And Dewey's progressive education really is extraordinarily anti-canonical in terms of its ideas of what children should be learning. Like, there are no authors that should be taught. There's just a sort of shifting curriculum. They'll be very fluid. We're all for that. All of this sounds really good until you have this idea of mass education, mass accountability, efficiency, and what I love in terms of C. Wright Mills' description of what happens in the 1950s and 60s with regard to large organizations, factories, and offices, is we have the emergence of a managerial demiurge. And if it sounds like a monster, it is. But this administrative ethos comes in, and what we need to do is administer the efficient use of educational resources in mass education in the 50s and 60s. And so all of this, the tests, the interests of the child, become configured in ways that are about maximizing results and efficiency and triage in the school system. So the administration and scientific management take on a kind of progressive cast, adopt the standardized test as a way of measuring each child's aptitude and capacities, and then says they're going to find ways of adjusting the education to suit the needs of the child. This justifies things like tracking. This will justify eventually things like college admissions. But from a very early age, we'll have the division of children into clear orders by high school. Vocational technical education of the 50s and 60s would be given to children who scored not so well on standardized tests. I also think, like, if I had to write the book over again, I would deal a lot with the representation of juvenile delinquency in the 50s and 60s. Because when you have what Hofstadter says is vocational technical education for, like, the working classes and the manual laborer just creates, like, this meaningless classroom and this education that's very, very obsolete, because business and industry keeps changing, and classrooms that are supposedly made to prepare you for the needs of the assembly line basically are become holding tanks for socially marginal students. And this gets figured in American popular imagination through the figure of the juvenile delinquent, like the kid who's just drifting through schools. And eventually in the 1980s, we call it the culture of poverty and social promotion and all these things. But Hofstadter really actually describes very well, like, the meaninglessness of this kind of low-grade practical education that we're giving to the low scorers. And
yeah, I went through American high school, public schools in the 60s and relatively good suburban public school system, and, you know, I was tracked pretty highly, and it still was deadly dull.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just the low scorers that had to suffer through this.
The evisceration of the... Well, you know, I was thinking on my way over here that partially what happens is with this sort of administrative high ideal of social efficiency and relevance that haunts American education from, you know, the early part of the 20th century, and the actual experience of the classroom and all of our experiences in the classroom is extraordinary divergent. So you have this highfalutin administrative language, this, like, actually on-the-ground experience of alienation, and I actually think that this kind of divergence between admin speak and on-the-ground experience, that's, like, a critical part of preparation for life in the administered world, as Adorno would call it, like, just cynicism, basically. Like, you hear all these lofty commencement speeches, and then you're, like, actually bored out of your mind, whether you're taking Shakespeare or mechanical, whatever, repair, or shop. Then you're just prepared to be alienated, to be cynical, to be apathetic, to be, in the words of Hannah Arendt, mass man.
That's a good life skill to have.
It's a kind of demobilization, psychological demobilization, as a function of class formation in the educational system that I think has been really, really effective. And it continues to work its way into the university system and into life in any large organization or in the dot-com era, as you described it. Highfalutin language, impossible utopic aspiration, actual nitty-gritty exploitation, expropriation, profit-driven brutalism. And so we're really used to living in this way, like on the ground, hideous labor conditions, on the discourse, like high and lofty ideals about the social good, and then we end up having this kind of demobilized, cynical, short-term thinking subject.
I'm speaking with Catherine Liu, who is a professor at UC Irvine and also author of American Idol from the University of Iowa Press. Of course, throughout all this, we go through these periods of national anguish about the crisis in the schools. I guess the most recent iteration of this started in the early 80s with the Reagan administration and the rising tide in mediocrity. What do you make of these periodic hand-wringing exercises?
If I were to be truly conspiracy-oriented about this, I would think these kinds of crises are produced and solutions are created whereby private corporations can enter in at charter schools, private schools, for-profit organizations, and right now, like, the computer industry can enter the school system and expropriate public funds because they will help improve education. So ETS administers standardized testing as a result of the nation's at-risk report in the K-12 systems. And you pay a lot of money to administer these tests. California pays millions of dollars a year to have this kind of an accountability metric. Every classroom should have 10 new Apple iMacs because that's going to really improve education. Every time you have this crisis, you have this incursion of private interest into public schools, you also have the empowerment of a kind of radical administrative strategies, you know, firing teachers who aren't good, this attack on seniority and tenure. And so you have this kind of admin war that gets inflamed during these moments of incredible crisis. A really interesting figure in the history of all of this is Diane Ravitch, who was one of the authors of A Nation at Risk, the Reagan Commission that talked about the rising tide of mediocrity in American schools. She has since then completely reneged on administrative reforms from the top down as a solution to repair the American educational system, and has become a vocal advocate for teachers' unions. One of the things about teaching in the classroom is that it takes experience. It takes work, long years of work experience and job stability to create a kind of craft relationship to the pedagogical experience. And I talk about this from experience only as a college professor, but I know that if I were looking over my shoulder and about to be fired at any moment, I would be a worse teacher. And so we have into K through 12 education all these reformers, including Arne Duncan, Obama's guru in all of these things, saying, you know what we need? We need to be able to fire teachers. That's actually going to make education better. That's the newest iteration of this. We need more tests. We need more computers. And we need to be able to fire teachers because there's something like this deadly, like parasitic person on the American body politic. It used to be the welfare mother. Right now, it's the public union, public school teacher that is destroying the American educational system. This is just simply not true, but it's become the common wisdom.
When I interviewed the Hoover Institution's education pundit, Terry Moe, he disclosed that teachers don't get any better after 5 years of experience, so might as well just fire them and get a new crop of young ones. Now, that, first
That's
of all,
astonishing.
It's kind of amazing to believe that people don't learn by doing, get better with time. But also it seems like it's a cost-cutting strategy. Just get kids straight out of college, pay them nothing, and then when they start expecting a decent salary, kick them out and find a new crop.
The great thing about that cost-cutting strategy is that it also has a psychological effect, and it has a powerful ideological effect that I also talk about that synergistically fits right in with standardized testing and the culture of high-stakes testing, which is that you always look for short-term solutions, and you think of human beings not as workers whose value accumulates with their experience, but as disposable people whose exploitation can only happen in this very, very explosive way, and then they have to be thrown out. So the total destabilization and insecurity of the American workforce creates, as you talked about last night in terms of the crisis of the 1970s, and that you've talked about before and others too, it creates a passive, a frightened, and a cowed workforce. And that's really great if you want to decrease wages and increase profits. That's great. That's a great strategy. So if you throw away people after 5 years, that is fantastic on so many different levels, because you have people who are scared and you have this massive collective devaluation of experience as such. The SATs are a perfect example of how explosive future potentiality in young people is measured, because that's what the aptitude test is supposed to, is future achievement. It's not supposed to
they
measure.
They dropped the aptitude now. It's just,
well, yeah, it's just, it doesn't
pure
mean
initials
anything.
Now,
I'm still looking to call it, yeah. The test is supposed to measure your potential for future achievement. It's actually not supposed to measure past achievement. So there's very little, like, actual content, academic or human, what I would think of as humanistic content in the SAT general. The specific subjects are different, have, you know, try to measure content. So what you have is a country that, a national imagination that fetishizes this kind of short-term problem-solving, self-exploitative attitude that maybe will last 5 years on anything. Teaching, however, is, I'm going to reiterate this, is a craft like any other. You don't want someone who's a newbie to, you know, be in the, let's say the New York Philharmonic fires musicians after 5 years because they think they've done the best with them. Think about, you know, Richard Sennett wrote about this, so it's on my, it's on my mind right now. Think about this in the Renaissance guilds. Like, what if they fired craftsmen after 5 years? Like, you're just done. You made that Stradivarius, but your best years are behind you. Goodbye. Go, you know, move river rocks. This is literally how the managerial demiurge in America is thinking about the American worker right now.
But it's also very stratified because, you know, just parenthetically, Mo himself has been at Stanford for 30 years, so he doesn't listen to his own advice. But what we're getting for maybe the bottom half of the population is much more militarized schools. There are charter schools in New York where students are not allowed to talk to each other at lunch. Now, you go back in the past, and it looked like the schools were there to prepare people for life in a factory.
Mm.
People talk to each other in a factory. Mm-hmm. The people talk to each other in an office. This hyper-militarized charter school, what are they preparing people for in these kinds of environments? Mm-hmm. Do you have any thoughts on that?
That kind of discipline seems to be going back to the most authoritarian abuses of the classroom that Joseph Meyer Rice observed in the New York City public school systems at the time, which was just the docile body. You're preparing people to be actually just to learn how not to move in a mass setting. And
well, it's like they're just preparing for prison.
For prison, yeah.
I mean, it's not like they're preparing for employment.
Yeah, yeah. Or I was thinking the army, prison or the army, which are the two options.
But then the elite sends its children to fancy progressive schools.
Yeah.
Where, you know,
yeah. That, who's a
small classes, loose curriculum.
$27K a year to $36K a year for the finest progressive education that money can buy. And on the Eastern Seaboard and on the West Coast, we have the situation where bankers and entrepreneurs and venture capitalists will send their children to the progressive schools of another era that once educated the children of the American left. Little Red Schoolhouse, St. Anne's in Brooklyn. These places have preserved, you know, the values of a very left-oriented progressivism that came out of these small classrooms, teacher engagement, social relevance, social equity, social mutual responsibility, free and creative thinking. So what do we have then? We have an underclass that's being prepared to enter the military or prison or a cynical cubicle job, a world of discipline. And then we have this small, and I would say deracinated global elite whose children are being prepared for creative life, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the rub, though. One of the reasons why they justify this kind of creative education for elites is actually that creativity will make them more competitive. Bottom line, everyone has to compete.
This brings us to some of the other concerns of your book. I've had any number of progressive education pundits on the show over the last few years, among them Diane Ravitch. And I've always asked them if the problems of our schools have anything to do with the anti-intellectualism in American life, and no one wants to touch that question. I'm guessing that you're not afraid to touch that question, so please do.
I think that it's been 100 years of progressive education almost in the United States, and what we have accepted is that education is always an ends-driven process, and that is, for Hofstadter, just deeply anti-intellectual. There's no such thing as education for itself, and there's no such thing as education for the mastery of a common language, common curriculum, common history, and objective reason that would allow us to become robust participants in a public sphere. Instead, we have this like pseudo-personalized education that's all about making us feel good and inspiring our interest. What it actually has produced is mass apathy and contempt and fear of academic content or anything like intellectual history or a shared common grounds for historical sharing.
It's like adjustment disguised as self-expression.
Yeah, yeah. And the left is as guilty as the right of this the state of this turpitude, because all those Pyrrhic culture wars were being fought during a time of massive capital consolidation were about, you know, Rousseau's bad, Voltaire's bad, dead white men are bad, we're going to read, you know, the living writings of, you know, relevant authors. Some of those living writings of relevant authors are good. Some of them are just not worthy of that much attention. And yet, because of the identity politics of especially the 80s and 90s, we ended up with an incredibly watered-down set of criteria for what children should be thinking about, for what high school students should be reading and thinking about. And today, the crisis in education is framed in terms of competitiveness. I think it should be framed in terms of, and this sounds, you know, old school, but in terms of academic content that really would undergird a sense of critical thinking, a sense of deep and massive skepticism that a lot of lip service is paid to, but no one really wants to actually commit to. Because if you actually put that into place, a common curriculum, it would actually shake up a lot of the countercultural convictions of left and right. And I say that because there's a very powerful countercultural right, too, that also hates...
The homeschooling?
Yeah. The common curriculum and things like that.
Well, also some leftists I know are homeschooling as well.
Yes.
They don't want to participate in the man.
Yes. Yes, I think it's a really interesting phenomenon, you know, the whole homeschooling movement. It's called a movement because it's about, you know, mobilizing parents to take back their children's education and something like that. It's a great way to retreat from yet another public space, to abandon yet another public space to cynical administrators and create the home as the site of authenticity and production. Yeah, if we do soon, you know, we'll be doing everything ourselves, right? Allegedly, in this imagination, it's this new communitarianism, libertarianism, that has to do with all these American fantasies of just going off the grid. I have to say, you know, personally, for me, American public education worked and was a powerful, powerful instigator because my teachers were progressive and because it was my introduction to American culture, because I grew up in a very isolated immigrant family in suburban New York, that it was American public education and a series of inspired teachers in the New York public school system that inculcated me with a sense of powerful egalitarianism, powerful democratic values that were not transmitted to me at home at all.
Yeah, if you look at this things together, the militarized model for the bottom half of the socioeconomic distribution, the people who are going off the grid and homeschooling and such, it's like they're all abandoning any notion of the schools serving in any way preparing people for self-government and a democracy. It's just...
That's right.
It's either discipline or total DIY culture.
That's right. And here's what... is missing from the formula for progressive education as it became institutionalized in the 40s and became the whole child became a cliche used by, you know, administrators, is they lost the sense of Deweyan collectivism. Education was about the collective enterprise. The standardized test about every child in a cubicle. In my son's school, they set up these cardboard shields around their desks when they take the standardized test because they don't want to prevent cheating. The progressive classroom was meant to be a model of collective life.
Well, that's a bad word in American
culture. It's absolutely a bad word.
And then bringing this to a conclusion, the anti-intellectualism and the suspicion of academic content also ties into another one of your themes, the distrust of elitism. And pointing a finger and calling someone an elitist is a popular American urge across the political spectrum. So how's this figure?
You know, in a nutshell, I think this kind of reflexive knee-jerk anti-elitism is thwarted class critique. Because we can't have class analysis and we don't think about class struggle in productive ways, this knee-jerk anti-elitism that I think comes out of, you know, all sorts of personal, reified notions of personal comfort and things like, that makes me uncomfortable, that must be elitist. That notion of exclusion is so simplistic, so easy to evoke, that it's all about actually silencing dissent, silencing real engagement, disagreement, robust debate. The moment you call someone an elitist or you call a situation elitist, you are trying to up the ante on some kind of ordinary authenticity that is justified by its own commitment to, I think, a pseudo-democratic idea of low barriers to entry. So then you can dismiss the person who's talking and what you don't understand as exclusionary, as, you know, oppressive on this totally, like, spatio-temporal rather than economic, historical level. Like, I just feel excluded from what's going on here because I don't understand it. It must be elitist. This kind of radical disrespect, this kind of radical silencing is seen, you know, you and I have talked about it in left circles as much as in the right-wing dominated, you know, airwaves of Fox News, for instance. It's just, it's really astonishing to me. As I said in this LA Review of Books, I just heard someone talk about, a graduate student talk about fan culture as elitist because on these fan forums online, your opinion isn't taken seriously if you're a newbie. Now, fan culture and Henry Jenkins and all these, you know, fan cultural studies types would dismiss me and, you know, certain people who came out of traditional humanities PhD programs as elitist because we might talk about Marx or Hegel or Adorno. Let's talk about Adorno. But we've upped the ante so much on elitism now, it's like if you actually are an expert of some kind of popular cultural object, you're also an elitist because you're not taking into account the opinion of someone who knows nothing about that popular cultural object. So it's a sort of dive to the bottom of ignorance, and it's been used as a cudgel in many, many ways to silence meaningful and perhaps productive dissent on the left.
That puts me in mind of the best thing that George Bush ever said, the soft bigotry of low expectations.
Yes, that's true.
Thank you, Catherine.
Okay.
That was Catherine Liu, who teaches at UC Irvine and who is the author of American Idol. That's with a Y, not an O, from the University of Iowa Press. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, Gigue, from Bach's Partita No. 2 for violin, again performed by Henrik Schiering. Till next week, bye.